Good evening. All this gear. Thank you. Merci. Merci à tous en personne et en ligne. And I feel thank you to Norman, who's in my back. Can you believe that? I just want to say that I kind of miss not being able to see the online sangha on their on the little Zoom squares that we all know. So I want to do like the same as I did in my first in my weekly Shuso messages, which is I'm going to start with a sentence from Shunryu Suzuki in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Oh, and I'm going to read to you in French. It's a short one, so. Évidemment, vivre, c'est créer des problèmes. Si nous ne faisions pas notre apparition dans ce monde, nos parents n'auraient aucune difficulté avec nous. And the English for that is, of course, to leave is to create problems. If we did not appear in this world, our parents would have no difficulty with us. So this is the third or fourth time now that I give a Way-Seeking Mind talk, and each time it's different. Clearly, my Zen practice influences them. Until today, the only way I could figure to give such a talk was to write in chronological order. But then I always find it difficult to decide what to choose to tell. I also find it that it is so easy to get caught in the trapping of life details. And my life is really just one skin bag story that seems so small when I think of the innumerable lives of past, present, and future. So this time, I did write my Way-Seeking Mind talk differently. I thought I'm going to stress what brought me to practice. And so I am going to list the eight main searching moments of my life. The first one is my childhood in France, to autism everywhere. Three, my love of tennis. Four, emigrating to the US. Five, having a child. Six, neck pain and sensory nightmare. Seven, I'm given a second life with proper diagnosis. Eight, discovering boundless Zen practice. Now, of course, these 8 points overlap with one another quite regularly. So forgive me, please, if I jump around chronologically a little bit. And I'm going to cap each point at the end with a short passage with what's going on these days. Now, I hope I don't forget anything relevant. I mean, I do sometimes. So, especially when I'm stressed. But writing down things like now helps. So, let's start with my childhood in France. I was born in 1964 and raised until the age of 23 in France, in a beautiful beach resort town in the west of France, Les Sables d'Olonne. My parents were, in the North American way of saying it, 100% French. Catholicism was the dominant religion in that part of France, and there were many Catholic churches and even crosses at road crossing. In fact, there is a history for that part of France of intense religious wars. So it's no surprise that this has been my mother's family's hometown for several centuries. So my mother was, not so surprisingly, a very devout chrétienne, Christian. Okay. She was also the secretary of the Catholic churches around town. Every week, we went to Mass, and I attended all the Catholic events. Several Catholic priests were large figures in my environment as a child. They shared many meals with us, either in our home or sometimes we went to Le Presbytère. And they participated in many of my childhood's life's activities. Hey, one of them even took tennis lessons from my father. From an early age, I learned that my mother seriously misunderstood me. I mean, I was a mournful and unsmiling child, and I was extremely sensitive and did not behave in the usual demonstrative way of children. No kissing, no I love you, no looking her in the eyes. And so my mother concluded that I did not love her. By the time I became a teenager, she and I were utterly at loggerheads. I blamed all my difficulties on her. My father was 60 years old when I was born. And by all accounts, he was a very colorful character. He had survived spending 25 years on Devil Island, the French Guiana penitentiary where he was sent for committing a murder. Probably some of you know Papillon, that kind of thing. Okay. So maybe due to this, his personality seemed built in iron. And I wrote more about it in the memoir I published in 2016 called Being Seen. Je dois un grand remerciement à mes parents. I thank my parents. I'm here. They gave me food, shelter, all these basics. In any event, one thing I never imagined when I listened to the talks given by the Catholic priest during Sunday Masses at the church, that someday I myself would give a talk. Another thing I never imagined is that I would end up living in another country. In fact, the closest I came to that one was the days in high school when, during recess, every day, I kicked the same rock around and around. And so I wondered how far it had traveled with all the many days of kicking it around. Got the same rock every day. You know, when I added up, it was a lot, and I wondered if I would ever go as far as the rock had. That was it. Now, there were many mini dramas in my childhood. I'm just going to give you the three main ones. So when I was about 12, I ran away from home on my bike one morning. But you know, all day was long, and before the night fell, I actually thought better of this plan, and I called my parents so they could send some cousin to pick me up. We had family everywhere, so in that around there. Another thing was when I was about 15, I swam away in the Atlantic Ocean with the goal of drowning myself, which is not as easy as it seems. A small fishing boat brought me back to shore where my mother, and I'm grateful to remember that, but then of course I did not tell her, was waiting for me with much anxiety. At 20, I swallowed the barbiturates I was given for my epilepsy and ended up having a stomach wash. Now, in the course of the hospitalization, I was raped by a male nurse, but that's another story, which is also in my memoir. Now, point number two about autism. My brand of autism, and I call it my brand because there are so many variations there too. From the first day I was born, I cried a lot and no one could figure out why. So this created many problems, both for myself and those who knew me. I was, and I still am, intense, easily spooked, or too easily in love. If someone does not smile at me, I rapidly conclude it means they do not like me. Similarly, if someone shows care, I have been known to develop unhealthy attachment for them, of course. Now, I'm going to try to give you a French expression that I like to describe this thin skin problem. And I don't really know how to translate it, except with further explanations. The French words are à fleur de peau. Literally, it means to the flower of the skin. These words don't make any sense. So I checked Google Translate and it gives on edge as a translation. Not really what I mean. But anyway, I think you get the gist, I hope. That autism pervades every aspect of my life and that my nerves often feel like they are à fleur de peau. As I mentioned in my previous talk, my life was regularly shaken to its foundations when I experienced what is usually called meltdown episodes. And these happened more frequently when my hormones were most virulent, you know, as a teenager and during menopause. I think it's often the case with many autistic women. I don't know so much. Okay, I also call these episodes, I refer to it as falling into the abyss of the mind. Excuse me. And the reason I call it that was because after I had been practicing Zen for a few years, I was amazed to observe how little control over it I had. How quickly I became completely irrational. I mean, at these times, I often took a kitchen knife with the thought of killing myself. And then once the episode was over and I was back to my old self, really, I realized it was a really bad idea. So when I'm upset or faced with strangers, I have difficulty expressing what I feel. It's an autistic type of communication challenge, not necessarily understood or even perceived by others. Anyway, since I cannot change any of this, I live with it the best I can, knowing it. Well, knowing it, trying to understand it. Believe me, that's my entire life. In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I read a story that made complete sense to me. Here it goes. When Nishirasi Zen Jiang scolded his disciples, he always said, "Go away." One of his students took him literally and left the temple. But the master did not mean to expel the student. It was just his way of expressing himself. Instead of saying, "Be careful," he said, "Go away." If your parents have this kind of habit, you will easily misunderstand them. End of the quote. Now, it has been several years now without any serious falling into the abyss of the mind. I mean, of course, at times I can get angry. But I have experienced how others' anger deeply unravels me. And, you know, Shantidevas about anger. Anyway, I just don't want to do that to them. So I really try to remain silent. I move away as soon as I can. I'm lucky with that because, you know, when you can't. And then I silently cry because I, too, cry a ton. As much as I want. While I'm curled up in bed, biting the pillow. Now, I learned that one the hard way. Do not bite myself, because one time I drew blood, so no, none of that now. And a big one is paying attention to my breath. Surprise. And, you know, eventually I actually move on to my zafu. I mean, I'm talking to people who know the amazing power, wondrous power of Zen practice and Zazen. Okay, point number three, my love of tennis. I was 5 or 6 years old when I started to play tennis. My father passed on to me his love of the tennis game at an early age. In fact, in our living room, there was a picture of his father and mother playing tennis in the early 1900s. She wore a long skirt and was several months pregnant with my father, which you can't tell, corset, you know. My father was a tennis teacher at the local tennis club. In that club, there was one of those walls one can hit a tennis ball against alone. And I spent countless hours playing alone, repeating over and over the same thing. Well, eventually, I became quite skilled, but also because my father was coaching me at the time. Oh, I actually earned a little bit of money sometimes by winning a few tournaments. And once, I was called by the French Open organizers to play in the qualifications, where I promptly and utterly, utterly lost. I still remember how, as a teenager, my rage at being so misunderstood seemed to spend itself some when I walloped that ball. My diet of eating mostly starch. I did not want anything else. Did not sustain such strenuous exercise. And I developed an unhealthy habit of eating several pastries per day, going as far as to steal money from my mother in order to buy them. You know, French pastry, pretty good. So between my nervous and physical problems as a teenager, I started to have epilepsy and many other ailments, including so-called mononucleosis. I mean, I was tired all the time, so. No one understood what was going on exactly. But my chi, really, or my, I don't know, my energy really ebbed away and my level of play dropped significantly. The worst was that my families and friends, well, and me too, did not understand what was happening. And they thought I purposefully chose to no longer play so well. So throughout my life later, of course, I often tried to play tennis, but eventually I had to completely stop 25 years ago. It broke my heart to no longer be able to play. And then just to end that, I'll say that only less than 2 years ago, there's a shift that happened and I regained some chi and I started to play competitive again. Now I'm older and it's, you know, but I am absolutely delighted with that unexpected turn. Okay, point four, emigrating to the US. It's going to be a short one. But I have to talk about the fact that changing culture and language is definitely transformative. So I was 23 years old when I emigrated alone to Chicago, United States. Well, yeah. Where the boyfriend I had met in France lived. I remember at first I really felt I was on another planet. And I also remember that immediately I was relieved that differences were much more a part of the North American culture. As soon as I landed here, I became vegetarian. My diet drastically improved, and I stopped having epilepsy bouts. Little by little, I became used to this North American culture, and now it's part of my culture. After 6 months with my boyfriend, I left, and a year later, so met my son's father at a tennis tournament, fulfilling my mother's saying that tennis opens doors. And then it was only about 5 years after my arrival in the United States, actually four, yeah, that my son Martin was born. Now, having a child forced me to grow up. I mean, I love motherhood. I love my son, but at the same time, it took a heavy toll on me. So it's now 37 years later, and I actually have been here longer than in France. And I'm pretty confident that I would not have stumbled upon Zen if I had not been exposed to this North American Soto Zen practice. I mean, of course, there is Le Zen Soto in France, but to my eyes, it's just strict and scary. I mean, France is a little bit like that to me, okay? I mean, the formality is in fact very French. I mean, I don't know. Okay, point five, having a child. That was in January 1992 that my son Martin was born. Now, giving birth almost killed me. In fact, I cannot remember the moment Martin was born because I fainted right then. despite the orange bits that his father fed me to give me the strength to go on. Now, it's right after his birth that I understood I had serious sensory challenges. I mean, I still remember the cries and the smelly diapers, the sleep deprivation in order to feed the baby, the bloody nipples, the lights turned on in the middle of the night, and so on. Now, none of this diminished my love for Martin. But fights with his father grew more numerous. I resented having to always take care of the baby while he could escape to work. I think many do, many women, I don't know. I remember though when Martin was 7 months old, I took him on the L, which is the subway train in Chicago. I took him to the French consulate. That was a big, huge trip for me. So he would have his French citizenship because I thought he might find that very useful later in life. And guess what? He does. There were many fights with his father, but one I remember that was, I mean, we all make mistakes, but, you know, I wanted to drive Martin to the doctor because he was crying very hard and his ear hurt. And his father finally gave up after a long fight and said, "I am doing this for you, not for him." It was a lot of anger. And then the doctor told us that both the ears were infected. Now, again, I know we all make stupid mistakes, okay? I do too. But this argument affected me, so here it is. So we divorced when Martin was 5. Now, I am the one who wanted a divorce, and I never regretted it. But man, the struggle for ensuring a nest for my son was difficult. For many years, I was a single mother when Martin was with me. I did not have any family, nor financial help, and I was in a foreign country and with an undiagnosed serious problem. You can't imagine. At the time, I was a high school teacher usually in a city school. That was another traumatic experience that I relate in my book. I never lasted more than a year in one school. I think that is when my neck started to tighten up, which I will talk about further down. So about 2 years after the divorce, I knew I had some kind of problem that I needed to address, and you know, I moved to California and Green Gulch Farm, and I left Martin with his father and grandmother. I could not take care of Martin if I had not taken care of myself. That was my reasoning. After I left Green Gulch Farm, the terrible pain in my neck and its accompanying upshot of sensory problems started. I want to talk about this. But before I want to finish this point about, no, what even? I was a substitute teacher in, So when I moved away from Green Gulch, I became a substitute teacher in Marin County, and that's when I made a promise to myself. I remember, beautiful Marin, you know. I promised myself that I would bring Martin to live and go to school in Marin. But for that, I had to earn some money. I first upgraded my teacher credential for California standards because I had Chicago. And then I went to leave, and work as a teacher in San Francisco. Oh, also I went back to San Francisco State University to get my French master's. took it easy. Martin's father did not want to let him come back to live with me, and I had to go to court in Chicago. I applied to the San Francisco Department of Health in order to get minimal health insurance for Martin and me. And then when he was 10, finally, I was able to drive a rental truck with him from Chicago to California. Now, that trip was a trip. In my book, okay. In San Francisco, I found low-income activities for him, like learning to play tennis. Well, I had already started in Chicago, but, you know, San Francisco is a good town for low-income stuff. He was still young enough that I could play. Oh, yeah, my neck was hurting, so I'm left-handed. I could not play left-handed. So it was nice because when he was little, I could play right-handed with him. And then, you know, there is this happens to many hungry people, which is that I gave him the main share of our little food, right? And then I was quite hungry, and I remember sometimes staring seriously at the people in restaurants. But it did not last too bad. When we moved to Fairfax 20 years ago, Martin was 12. As he got older, I had less and less energy. Again, neck and sensory stuff. I was no longer able to take good care of him as a teenager. I mean, for example, I became too tired to cook a meal at dinner time. Nothing at dinner time, okay? And then at breakfast, we had to stay in the dark and eat mostly silently. I wrote down what I needed to tell him, I remember. So a few months shy of his 16th birthday, he moved with friend, including his father, close enough that I was still able to help him practically. Now Martin is 32 and he lives with his fiancée in Sausalito, so not too far, and we are good friends. I feel extremely, extremely lucky. I see him and them, of course, now every so often. We speak on the phone about once a week, and of course we play tennis together sometimes. He and I get along splendidly, and he's a person I can totally count on when in need. All right, point six, neck pain and sensory nightmare. Now, each time I try to talk about this, I am reminded that physical pain is something we have all experienced one way or another. And speaking of it is difficult. My entire spine is affected by the imbalance in my neck, from the very bottom to the brain. Though the pain is most acute at the base of my neck here on the left side. Whoops. Now, of course, I was totally caught in the survival thing and I ignored the irritation that actually had been in my neck when I looked back. It had been there before, a few years before my son was born. Now, eventually, of course, it's going to catch up. So in January 2000, a few days after coming out of Green Gulch, during what I called the night, a searing pain in my back woke me up. All I was able to do was slither slowly to throw up, then lie in bed completely still and fully awake. It was as if my entire spine rearranged itself in the wrong way. The reason why it did this is a mystery. In the morning, I found that even though I could stand up, I could no longer rotate my neck to the left at all. You know, I had to turn my whole upper body there because, you know, I had to keep working. I wanted my son to come back. And the problem got worse and worse, of course. And then in September 2006, a few months after Steve gave me Jukai, Steve Stuckey, I'll talk about that later, I actually fell to the floor. And when I slowly stood up, found that I was paralyzed from my upper back, arm, and neck, and had to use crutches to walk. Now, the crutches, it was very intermittent, I found out. Anyway, after almost losing my mind to the pain and challenges of this between 2006 and 2010, I was finally properly diagnosed and things slowly started to improve. And again, I'm going to give a Shunryu Suzuki little sentence. There is some limit, that's in Not Always So, by the way, the book. Anyway, there is some limit to our capacity to endure physical suffering. Anyway, at exactly the same time as this, my sensory problems went through the roof, and I had to wear serious headgear to protect myself inadequately, reinforce earmuffs with earplugs underneath, mask with a carbon filter, hat with a visor, maybe sunglasses. I mean, imagine how crazy I looked. A feeling I hated so much, but I just had no choice. Even movement made me nauseous. When a perfume smell hit me, it was like an iron bar, and the headache stayed. Okay, I could give you more example, but, you know. The medical establishment could not figure it out. And in fact, they sent me for treatment for my knee, since I sometimes limped from the pain in my neck. Okay, since that morning in 2006, every morning I lie down for an average of, well, now it's just 10 minutes, but it used to be longer than that. And in fact, that is what is the most useful of all. A doctor once wondered why there were black grill marks on my back. And that was the heating pad that I used alternately with an ice pack in order to be able to fall asleep. And then probably some of you have seen me here, many, maybe. For a few years, I used two crossed sticks to help support my back when meditating. I only limped intermittently, so that looked even stranger. And you know, I limped, that was very interesting to me, each time I was overexposed to any kind of stimuli or stress. It's like the knot in my neck tightened. I mean, stores, okay. So anyway, since I moved away from the source of noise or light as fast as I could, many people misunderstood that behavior and became angry at me. The traditional medical clinic that I picked for its quiet surroundings despite the distance in Point Reyes was extremely upset that I waited outside alone. Eventually, they kicked me out. A psychiatrist thought I was too impatient to wait and wrote that on an important medical record. A friend driver thought that my asking her to shut down her car radio was extremely impolite. And another driver friend angrily concluded that I was taking a nap when my cap was down on my eyes so as to protect me from the other car's headlights, and so on. Going out of my apartment became rare. I consider myself very lucky that at least I could bike. You know, the support of the saddle was really helpful to my spine. And so I was able to go early in the morning, like early, to some medical appointments. I'd wait in the dark, you know, anyway. And same thing with grocery shopping, though the noise, oh boy. And then Zazen. I was actually, I kept going to some Zazen meetings. At the time, without being able to use the brake, oh yeah, I could not brake on my bike. That's right, on the left side of my bike because of the pain. So anyway, it's Zen practice, I think, that eventually started me on the road to figure out, not that I have that mystery. Okay, a turning point was several years ago when I found out that even though the pain is in my left, it is the right side of my entire spine that needs attention. And again, Shunryu says, we heard Norman, I think, say that a few days ago, the important point is your exhalation, no kidding. And my chi started to come up a little bit. I said that before, I'm repeating myself. Ooh. So the important thing is that at the same time as the pain in my body diminishes, my sensory problems improve. Each exhalations all the way down my spine have me noticing how my neck is supported differently from one side of my head to the other side. And as I said before, I have been able to go back to my favorite childhood activity, tennis. And what I said all along was that it was not tennis that was the cause of my neck problem. It proved correct because I still have it. It hasn't disappeared completely. I don't know if it ever will. The power of Zazen and paying attention to my breath in healing the body often makes me feel pregnant with the desire to tell others about this. But you know, people who don't have a practice. I mean, I've seen many autistic children and adults with similar physical problems. Autistic, yeah. But I'm scared of saying this, and I need a gentle push. And I'm so glad that recently Norman told me I really ought to speak to the medical establishment. So I did that. We'll see. I have recently made efforts in that direction. Okay, point seven. I'm given a second chance at life with a proper autism diagnosis. Now, this one is completely overlapping in time with my Zen practice. I was slowly dying painfully and no longer able to work at all. When I was finally, and by the grace of Zen practice, I was finally properly diagnosed as autistic in 2010. But at the same time, this is a mixed bag, like everything, because to be labeled means that many people start patronizing you, often without even noticing that they're doing this. I was 46 years old when this happened, so fortunately the patronizing aspect of it did not hinder my working life so much. I have heard many horror stories from other autistic adults about this. This was for me a second chance at life. Really, little by little, everything changed. I started to receive help in many forms. Financial and medical support, the right medicine, better health coverage, treatments such as chiropractor, acupuncture, PE, etc. Most of all, I started to receive a small but steady monthly Social Security disability allotment. Practically speaking, I can no longer work. I'd rather be poor and healthy than dying and earning money, more money. Now, writing a memoir also helped unburden myself. And then a few months after my diagnosis, the first thing I did was to go to be with other autistic adults. And I met my partner, Greg. And guess what? He also has a meditation practice. I have been living with him for over 13 years now. We are just able to afford our one-bedroom apartment in Fairfax, California. And despite the challenges, we both are so grateful to be able to live in this beautiful and privileged area. And then the last point, discovering Zen practice. Now I'm going to go back to 1998 when I was still living in Chicago, because that's when a friend gave me the book Nothing Special by Charlotte Jocobek. I really liked that read, that book. I mean, it seemed to make sense. And I saw then that I had no other choice but to explore that avenue. So my yoga teacher, when he heard me speak about the book, actually told me about Green Gulch Farm. I was a teacher at the time, so during the 2 weeks of Easter break, I went to Green Gulch. And I decided by then that I would move to live there at the end of the school year. Now, in order to move to Green Gulch, I had to let go of, a few possessions, apartment, car, furniture, and so on. But the most difficult, by a large margin, was to leave my seven-year-old son, who stayed with his father and grandmother in Chicago for the next 3 years. Arriving in San Francisco, I brought only two suitcases and a satchel with all my important documents in it. Well, that's also what allowed me to come back on track. So, yeah, it's always two sides. Again, a Shunryu sentence. If you could compare the kind of life based on this practice with what is happening in this world or in human society, you will find just how valuable the truth Buddha left us is. After I left Green Gulch Farm 25 years ago, I kept doing Zazen every day, at first only 30 minutes at a time. Now, it's worth mentioning that I was lucky to be able to sign up with Everyday Zen right at its inception, because there was a sign-up sheet for it in the sheet. Sorry, pardon my French. there was a sign-up sheet for it in the Green Gulch dining room. And that was just about the last time, my last meal, while I was there as a resident. Now, how fortunate is that? Now, it's true that for many years, I did not really attend very much at all. I mean, I tried once in a while to go to an all-day sit at the Marin Headland. When I moved to Marin County, that was 20 years ago, I looked for a place to sit Zazen that was closer to my place in Fairfax. And that's how I found Steve Stuckey with Dharma Eye Zen Sangha in San Rafael. And I was there for the next 2 or 3 years with Ren. Also, I met Nellie Davidson there. In 2006, Steve gave me Jukai. That was only a month before I became completely paralyzed in my upper body, my left arm, and I had to stop driving altogether. And then Steve died about 10 years ago. It might be helpful to mention that I kept attending all along some everyday Zen all day sits. Then by then my son was back with me, and, you know, between that and my lack of financial means, it was really intermittent. But I have to say that all the sanghas I have been in have helped me financially big time, as well as I got many, many car rides and more. And I express my gratitude to all those who made this journey possible. And some people went out of their way to pick me up in Fairfax, like John. And then there was Jeff. There is. Okay, when it became impossible for me to attend the evening San Rafael Dharma Eye Sangha, I searched for yet another place I could go on my bike early in the morning, when, you know, it was still mostly quiet and lights were subdued. So that's how I found Mountain Source Sangha. At first, we met in San Rafael with Tigan Dan Layton when he was still living in California. And then when he left, we had several other teachers, including Christina Lenher, Rick Sloan, eventually Leila Smith Buckhart in Corte Madera took over the group. So I kept biking there in the dark every morning. Every week, once a week. Leila died rather abruptly 16 months ago, and Dan Gudgel became the Mountain Source Sangha teacher. We now meet once a week in San Anselmo. When my son left our home in Fairfax in 2008, I started to sit much longer in my home, since after all, I could not go out very much at all and do much. So, you know, zazen. Oh, but as soon as I got a little bit stronger, I realized I could attend everyday Zen a little bit more. You know what? Come to think about it. I did not put that in my note. I remember it was Norman who said, well, why don't you come to Wednesday evenings? See, your gentle push. Okay, gentle push here. Why did I write there? Okay, Shunryu's quote, the most important things in our practice are our physical posture and our way of breathing. Oh, and then 5 years ago, I wanted to experience what it was like to have concentrated Zen practice with like-minded people. And I had received some money from the sale of my great-grandfather's painting. Not much, but enough for me to join the 2019 winter practice period at Tassajara, which Norman and Kathy led. When Norman asked me to be the Shuso last summer, I was overwhelmed and unable to speak for a few seconds, and even shedding, of course, a few tears. I closed my eyes and I thought of Leila, and Leila's main teaching came to me. She said, Leila, again and again, say yes. And so I did, and here I am. And then I'm going to end with a quote from Pema Chodron, a quote that I dearly love. So I'll say it first in French, it's only three lines. La compassion n'est pas une relation entre le guérisseur et le blessé, c'est une relation entre égaux. Ce n'est que lorsque nous connaissons bien nos propres ténèbres que nous pouvons être présents face aux ténèbres des autres. La compassion devient réelle lorsque nous reconnaissons notre humanité commune. Compassion is not a relationship between the healer and the wounded. It's a relationship between equals. Only when we know our own darkness well can we be present with the darkness of others. Compassion becomes real when we recognize our shared humanity. numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible.